Jewish marriage, part 4. So just to recap what we were discussing yesterday, we were discussing women that you're not allowed to marry, and then hopefully today we'll finish up that discussion, and we will talk about women that you should marry, who you should marry. So yesterday we discussed, we said that there were 6 categories of women that you're not allowed to marry. So just to go very quickly through it, we said the first category was women that you get kares for having relations with. Right, mostly close relatives, the incest that's written in the Torah in Leviticus 18 and 20. The second category was the secondary incest, the cases of secondary incest, which are rabbinic in origin. There's no kares, there's no death penalty, it's just rabbinic law. The third category was kares through tradition, kares that's not written in the Torah, but it's written in the prophets. In the prophet of Malachi, specifically, there's only one case in this category. That's the case of marrying or having relations with a non-Jewish woman. The next category we discussed yesterday was the case of a person who violates a negative and positive commandment. And that was all the cases we discussed yesterday were cases of a Kohen who marries somebody that he's not allowed to marry. So that's a positive and a negative violation. Today we're going to discuss 2 more categories. The 5th category is a category of women that if you marry them, you violate a negative commandment. And the 6th category are women that if you marry them, or you have relations with them, you're violating a positive commandment. So let's go, category number 5, the women that if you marry them, you violate a negative commandment. So all the people that fall into this category are prohibitions. All these prohibitions are prohibitions that we call prohibitions of the assembly or of the congregation. These are women that are not allowed to enter the assembly or the congregation of God. This is what it says in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, right, all of these people, all these different cases are mentioned. So the first one that we're going to talk about is the case of the mamzer. We mentioned before that a mamzer is the offspring of a forbidden union of two people that, if they have relations with each other, it incurs a punishment of kares. So like, let's say a man has relations with his daughter or mother or father's wife or his wife's sister, all these different people, and they have a child. So the child or a man has relations with a married woman who's not his own wife. So the child in all these cases is a mamzer, and a mamzer is what we say is forbidden from joining or from marrying into the congregation of Hashem. Right? Yes, sir.
Just real quick, someone like menstruating woman. The reason why we can't touch a woman who's our wife who's menstruating.
Yeah.
Is so we wouldn't be tempted to then have relations, right? We wouldn't get kares if we just touched our wife who's menstruating.
Right. You wouldn't get kares for doing that.
It's
offense, but it's offense that, according to most commentators, is not of rabbinic origin, but the Torah itself already makes the offense. The Torah itself makes offense. Because the Torah itself says, don't approach these people. Don't approach these ladies. So coming close means doing things that, you know, are considered forms of intimacy besides the actual act of sex. Right. Or that might lead to the act of sex. Right? Fine. So the definition of a mamzer, right, in English they call a mamzer a bastard or an illegitimate child. That's not quite what the halachic definition is. We just said that the halachic definition of a mamzer is a child who's born from a union which incurs the punishment of kares. Okay? That's what a mamzer is. A mamzer is not allowed to enter the congregation of Hashem. He's not allowed to join the congregation of Hashem through marriage. We'll see what that means in a few moments. That's one definition of a mamzer. And another definition of a mamzer is that a child of a mamzer is a mamzer. So you can have a man who has relations with his sister, right? They have a child, and that child is a mamzer, right? That child, who happens to be a mamzer, is not allowed to marry anybody else. But let's say that child marries somebody else, whether the other person is a mamzeres, a female mamzer, which is permitted for such a mamzer to marry, right? A mamzer is allowed to marry. A male mamzer and a female mamzer are allowed to get married. But let's say this mamzer marries somebody. It doesn't matter if the other person is a mamzer and it was permitted. It doesn't matter if the other person was not a mamzer and it was an illegal marriage and they have another child, right? So that child is also a mamzer because one of his parents was a mamzer. So the definition of a mamzer is somebody who the union of his parents is a punishment of kares, or if one of his parents is a mamzer itself. Is that it? Yeah? Okay, so that's one case of the category of women or people that you're not allowed to marry because of a punishment of a negative commandment.
So the whole lineage becomes mamzer.
What?
Then the whole lineage becomes mamzer.
Right, the whole lineage becomes mamzer. There is a thing that a mamzer only happens, you can only be a mamzer if you're Jewish, right? And so if you're not Jewish, so then you're just not Jewish, and then you can convert and you're not a mom anymore, right? So let's say a non-Jew had relations with his mother or sister or whatever and had a child, so then that child is not Jewish, right? And then the child converts, so he's not a mamzer because he just became a Jew now, right? So according to halacha, a mamzer is only going to be born of two Jews. Well, unless they have a mamzer who had relations, let's say a mamzer woman, a Jewish female mamzer, had relations with a non-Jewish man, so the child will be a mamzer. But let's say you have a non-Jewish man who has relations with a Jewish woman who's married. Right, so usually if a Jewish man has relations with a married Jewish woman that's not his wife, the child is a mamzer. But if it's a non-Jewish man that has relations with a Jewish woman who's married, so the child is not a mamzer.
Can you be like a born-again Jew?
What?
Like if you're a mamzer, can you like go to the mikvah for a while and become a born-again Jew?
No, there's no such thing. Your lineage is your lineage. You can't change. You know, they say you can't pick your parents. You could pick your could pick your son-in-law, but you can't pick your children, right? That's what they say. So a mamzer is a mamzer. If his father is not Jewish, right, and his mother is Jewish, even if she's married, so then it's going to be a mamzer, because even though we said that having relations with a non-Jew incurs the punishment of kares according to tradition, but that doesn't make the kid mamzer, right? So actually, I was once in a debate with a Christian. Or it was a sort of online discussion that they were emailing me. It wasn't a real debate. But I consistently referred to Jesus as the bastard from Bethlehem. That's how I always refer to him. So, well, according to tradition, the way we understand the history of what happened to Jesus was that his mother was betrothed to a guy named Joseph, right? Mary and Joseph, they did kiddushin, but they didn't do the second stage of marriage. They didn't like finalize their marriage. And then she went and she committed adultery with a Roman soldier. That's the basic understanding of what happened. So the resulting child is Jesus. So I called him the bastard of Bethlehem for that reason. So this guy who knew a little bit about halacha, he said to me, but he's not halachically a bastard because his father wasn't Jewish. So why are you calling him the bastard of Bethlehem? So I said, yeah, it's just fun to call him that because, you know, I like to make fun of him. Even though technically, according to halacha, that wouldn't make a kid a mamzer. But so mamzer is someone that's prohibited for all generations. Right? The son of a mamzer, grandson, great-grandson, etc., all the way down. Whether it's a female mamzer to marry a regular Jewish woman or a male mamzer to marry a male mamzer to marry a female Jewish woman, or a female mamzer to marry a regular Jewish man, it's going to be this prohibition. The other prohibition that's mentioned over there in Deuteronomy 23 is that an Ammoni and a Moabi are not allowed to join the congregation of Hashem. Meaning, a person from the nation of Ammon or the nation of Moab is not allowed to marry into a regular Jewish family. Right? The nation of Ammon and Moab. The Gemara tells us that according to tradition, this prohibition only applies to male members of the Ammonite or Moabite nations. Right, a female Moabite or Ammonite, you're allowed to marry, but if you're a woman, a Jewish woman, you're not allowed to marry a male Ammonite or Moabite. And this prohibition goes for all generations. Once, even if they convert to Judaism, they're still not allowed to marry a regular Jew. The Torah tells us, this is in Deuteronomy 23, verse 4, it says, "A Ammonite or Moabite cannot enter the congregation of Hashem. Even the 10th generation, they should not enter the congregation of Hashem for eternity." Why? It says, "Al davar shelekidmaschem balechem uvamayim baderech betzeslam imitzrayim." Because of the matter that they did not greet you with bread and water when you were on the road as you exited Egypt. Right? The Ammonites and the Moabites, they're sort of their cousins of the Jewish people, because they're descendants of Avraham Avinu's nephew Lot. And you would have expected them to greeted the Jews with hospitality, the same hospitality that Avraham Avinu treated his nephew Lot with, and instead they didn't give bread and water to the Jews when the Jews were traveling in the wilderness. And because of that, the Ammonites and Moabites, at least the males of the Ammonites and Moabites, are banned from marrying into the Jewish congregation. The Gemara explains, Why are only the males prohibited from marrying in, but the females are permitted to marry in? So the Gemara says, because the whole grievance that we have against the Ammonites and the Moabites is the fact that they didn't come out and greet us and bring bread and water while we were traveling outside in the desert. Right? So the Gemara says that the nature is that women stay home, and the men would be the ones that you would expect to go out and bring supplies to, you know, a neighboring or a friendly army, right, or a friendly camp. It's the men that we were expecting should bring this bread and water, because the women, you always expect the women to be staying at home. The Gemara quotes a verse in Proverbs that says, "Kol kvayda bas melech pnima." All the glory of a bas melech, of a princess, is pnima, is inside. Right, so this idea of modesty, of staying in the inside and not revealing oneself and not being flamboyant in that way and bombastic in that way, is something that the Gemara expected even of these, you know, Gentile nations. And that's why the women are permitted and the men are not permitted to marry into the Jewish congregation. There's another idea when you look at the history of the Ammonites and the Moabites. If you look all the way back at their origins, so it talks about in Genesis, after the destruction of the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, as they say in English, right, the five cities of Sodom. So Lot runs away and he goes to a cave and he runs. He's fleeing with his two daughters, and basically what happens is that his two daughters have relations with him in the middle of the night, and one gives birth to the Ammonites and one gives birth to a boy and calls him Moab. And he's the father of the Moabites, and one gives birth to a boy and calls him Ammon, and he's the father of the Ammonites. Right? So that's the origins of the Ammonites and the Moabites. So the Gemara says that Lot himself actually had some sort of fantasy that he wanted to be with his daughters, and so he wasn't acting completely in a clean way during this story. They got him drunk and they had relations with him, and he fathered these children through his daughters.
He didn't know the first night, but he knew the second night.
Right. So the Gemara says that he didn't know the first night, and then he realized the second night, he still did it again. So he had bad intentions. But the women, the two daughters themselves, they had good intentions, because they thought the world was destroyed and it was their obligation to repopulate the world. And we said in the first year that the purpose of one of the purposes of the world is that it should be populated. So they felt the responsibility to repopulate the world. So they said, "There's no one else around, so we have to impregnate ourselves from our father." So they were acting, at least what they thought was properly, and he had bad intentions. So according to that, we can understand the difference between the male Ammonites and Moabites and the female Ammonites and Moabites. The ultimate patriarch was Lot. And Lot had bad intentions, so we don't want to have anything to do with him. So the males are not allowed to marry into the Jewish congregation. But the females, the two daughters of Lot, had good intentions, and therefore, even though they were doing a sin, which, you know, even for Noahides, we have on the list the six sexual unions that are forbidden even to Noahides, and one of them is... maybe it could be there might be some technical... All right, I'm not sure, but it could, the standard assumption is that it would probably be even forbidden for Noah to have relations with his daughters, and still, even though they were doing something that was prohibited, but they had good intentions, so we allow the females of the Ammonite and Moabite nations to marry into the Jewish people. Fine. So this is the category of negative commandments. A negative commandment for the Mamzer, the Ammonite, and the Moabite to join the Jewish congregation. That means that they're not allowed to marry a Jew of full lineage, a Jew who has full Jewish lineage, but a Jew who is not born Jewish, but was rather a convert to Judaism, or was originally a slave and was freed and became Jewish because freeing a slave involves converting him into Judaism. That's according to the halacha. So in those two cases, a convert or a freed slave is actually allowed to marry a Mamzer or an Ammonite or a Moabite. Right? So the whole prohibition only applies to a Jew of full Jewish lineage, not to a Jew who is a convert or a freed slave. But so that's the category of women that you're not allowed to marry because of a negative prohibition. Now, this category of women that you're not allowed to marry because of a negative prohibition, as well as the last category that we spoke about yesterday, of the one with the negative and positive prohibition. So every time that there's a negative prohibition involved, so if there's witnesses and a warning, so a person is liable for lashes, right? It's called Malchus 39 lashes that a person can get. The Beis Din can rule that he has to get these 39 whippings, and that's the corporeal punishment that a person gets for violating a negative commandment. These cases, if you try to do Kedushin, so the Kedushin actually does take effect. So if you do Kedushin to an Ammonite, you do Kedushin to a Mamzer, so the Kedushin does work, even though you're prohibited from having relations with them and prohibited from being married to them. If you have a child with them, the child is not a Mamzer, except for the case of the Mamzer, right? A child from an Ammonite or Moabite is not a Mamzer. But that's category number 5. Category number 6 is the prohibition of women that you're not allowed to marry, not because of a negative commandment, but because of a positive commandment. Right? There's 3 such cases. The first case is the case of a Kohen Gadol. This is in Leviticus chapter 21, where it says that a Kohen, we mentioned yesterday that a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry all the women that a Kohen is not allowed to marry, plus he's not allowed to marry a widow. Right? Besides that, there's a positive commandment that a Kohen Gadol is supposed to marry a virgin. Right? And, well, we don't have Kohen Gadol nowadays anyway, so it's not really applicable. But there is a positive commandment that a Kohen Gadol is supposed to marry a virgin. And if he marries a woman who's not a virgin, then he has violated this positive commandment. Right? The Gemara says that there's an idea called Lav Haba Mechlal Asei, a negative prohibition which is derived from the wording of the Torah, which is said in a positive form. It says, do this, v'hu isha b'vsuleha yikach, he should take a woman when she is a virgin, says, it implies, don't marry a woman who's not a virgin, right? So by marrying a woman who's not a virgin, he's violating a positive commandment, right? So that's the case of the Kohen Gadol marrying a non-virgin. That's one case of a positive commandment. And the other two are also in Deuteronomy chapter 23, where it says, this is in 23 verse 8, Lo yisaev adoimi, do not reject an Edomite, ki achichahu, because he is your brother. Lo yisaev mitzri, do not reject a mitzri, an Egyptian, ki ger hayisav artai, because you are a stranger in his land. Right, so our brothers, you know, Yaakov and Esav were brothers, and Esav's alternate name is Edom. Right, so the Edomites are descendants of Esav. So our brothers are the Edomites are really our brothers. So don't reject him because he's your brother. And the Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, right, we were strangers in their land. They turned us into slaves, right? But still, we should have some sort of recognition of the fact that they allowed us to be in their land for so many years. So don't reject them either, because you were a stranger in their, you were a sojourner in their land. What does the Torah say in verse 9? Banim asher yivoldu lehem dor shlishi their descendants or their children who are born to you, who are born to them in the third generation, Yovei Lehem Bekal Hashem, they may enter the congregation of Hashem. So what it says is that a Egyptian or an Edomite who converts to Judaism, you're not allowed to marry for the first two generations. For the third generation, you are allowed to marry. But the way the Torah words this prohibition is in a positive way. It says, you're allowed to marry someone from the third generation of an Edom or of Egypt. An Egyptian or an Edomite of the third generation, you're allowed to marry. Which implies that you're not allowed to marry a first or second generation Edomite or Egyptian. Right? So that's another category of women that you're not allowed to marry. Women that you're not allowed to marry because of a positive commandment. This is a Kohen Gadol marrying a non-virgin, and this is also a regular Jew marrying a Mitzri or Adomi before the third generation. Being a Mitzri or Adomi who converts the first and the second generation after the conversion, you're not allowed to marry because of this positive commandment. Because this is only a positive commandment, it's not technically a negative commandment. The Torah does not say do not do this, rather it says do this, which implies don't do something else. So because of that, if a person violates this commandment even with witnesses and a warning, he does not get malchus, he does not get lashes. And certainly if a person does kiddushin to one of these people, the kiddushin does work. So if the Kohen Gadol does kiddushin to a woman who's no longer a virgin, the kiddushin works. Or if a man does kiddushin to a woman who's a mitzris, an Egyptian of the first or second generation after they converted, so the kiddushin does work, even though he's not supposed to marry her. And if they have a child, the child is not a mamzer. Right? These are all the prohibitions of what we call an iser esse, a positive prohibition. Right? It's a prohibition that's resulting of a positive commandment. Now, there's an interesting idea that, you know, I'm talking about Ammonites and Moabites and Egyptians and Edomites. Like, you're probably thinking to yourself, like, is this really relevant nowadays? Do we have Ammonites and Moabites nowadays, or Egyptians or Edomites, or how would we know? So, right. So the Gemara says that in the time of Sancheriv was the king of Assyria. He's the one who exiled the northern kingdom of Israel. Right? The Jewish people split in the time of the Book of Kings, split into two kingdoms. There was the southern kingdom of Judah, and there was the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes. So he's the one who exiled the ten tribes. Actually, he didn't do it. His predecessor did, but he tried to conquer the kingdom of Judah. So the Assyrians were the ones who exiled the Jewish, a large portion of the Jewish people. They actually conquered a large portion of the Middle East, right? What's modern day Jordan, Syria, part of Iraq, Egypt. They conquered the whole, most of that area. They tried to conquer Judah, but there was a whole miracle in the time of Hezekiah. We're not going to get into that right now. But that was the Assyrians. So the Gemara says that when the Assyrians conquered this area, what they did was they had a policy of population movement. They would force the population and relocate them from one area to a different area and move everyone around. And because of that, you cannot assume that people that live in the area that was historically Ammonite or historically Moabite, that the people that live there now are Ammonites or Moabites. And therefore the prohibitions of the Ammonites and Moabites and Edomites and all these people is not applicable nowadays. That's what the Gemara says. So it's not something that you have to worry about.
So, like, if Mashiach was to come, those people we would know those people, though?
Maybe.
We would, like, they would, like, glow a different color or something?
It could be. I mean, there are sources that say that when Mashiach comes, he's going to tell every person, like, what tribe they're from, what family they're from exactly. I'm not aware of any sources that say that he's going to talk about the nations of the world and say which nation historically they're originally from, like each person. I don't know. It could be that it's the same idea, but I haven't seen anyone that says that explicitly. Now, the Shulchan Aruch actually brings a machlokes, a disagreement between two important sources about the Egyptians. Is there a prohibition to marry an Egyptian nowadays after they convert the first and second generation? Right? Is there a prohibition to marry them or not? So the Shulchan Aruch brings two opinions. The opinion of the Rambam. The Rambam says that you're allowed to marry an Egyptian nowadays. He lived in Egypt actually for part of his life. And the opinion of Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, who says that no, the prohibition to Egyptians specifically does apply, even though the Gemara says that the prohibition to Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites does not apply because Sancheriv came and mixed up the nations of the world. But specifically in regards to the Egyptians, the Rosh says that it continues to apply. And he proves this from actually a verse that we read 2 days ago in the Haftarah. It's a verse in Jeremiah that says that the Egyptians will be exiled from their land, and it gives an exact duration to that exile. He says that they're going to be exiled from their land for 40 years. And so from that, the Rosh extrapolates that, well, now it's after 40 years, so we could assume that even though the Egyptians were exiled at some point in the time of Sancheriv, but they came back to their land, and therefore people that are from Egypt, you can assume that they are historically from the Egyptian nation, and therefore the prohibition would apply nowadays, according to the Rosh. Yeah. So the Shulchan Aruch doesn't make a final ruling. He just brings both opinions. I'm not sure what people actually do in practice nowadays. Like, let's say somebody from Egypt would want to come and convert and marry a regular Jewish woman, or if she was a woman and she wants to marry a Jewish man. I'm not sure what the rabbinical courts would say about that.
So what if you're like a baby that was born in Egypt that's not from Egypt?
A Jewish baby? A non-Jewish? Yeah, I don't know. It's like the same idea. I don't know what they would say. I haven't heard that it's a problem. So like, I would assume they would probably okay it. I don't know. What do you think, Yisrael Meir?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. You don't see too many Egyptians converting.
Yeah, that's also true. Right, so those are the six categories of women that you're not allowed to marry. Kares, secondary, incest, kares from tradition, negative and positive, and then just negative, and then just positive commandments. There's also two more cases of women that you're not supposed to marry. And one is the case of the Katlanis. The Katlanis is a woman who was married and then her husband died, and then she got married again and her husband died and her next husband died. So a woman who is twice widowed, right? A black widow, if you're allowed to say that. I know it's politically incorrect to say that.
That's
not the term.
It's referring to a spider.
It's referring to a spider?
Yeah, black widow is a type of spider.
So a woman who was widowed twice, you're not supposed to marry a woman who was widowed twice. Some say that even if a woman was divorced twice, so you shouldn't marry her. This is not really brought down so much in halacha, but there's a lot of discussion about this. And like, if it becomes a question, you'll ask your local halachic authority, and they'll tell you what to do. That's one case, the case of the katlanis. And another case is a case of a woman whose husband died whose husband was martyred, right? A woman whose husband was killed al kiddush Hashem through sanctifying the name of Hashem, right? A person who's killed because he's Jewish, let's say, he's killed because he's Jewish, so he's considered a kaddish. He's considered holy, like in Christianity, like, you know, just like to give you a better understanding. In Christianity, they have this idea of a saint. A saint is like a person who achieved a certain holy level, right? They were killed for different reasons, whatever, for defending the religion. So in Judaism, we have this idea that a person who is killed because of his religion, because he's a practicing Jew, let's say because he's a Jew, so he attains a certain spiritual level, he's called a kaddish, he's called holy, and his wife, according to many authorities, should not marry somebody else afterwards. That's that was actually a big problem after the Holocaust. So a lot of Jews, a lot of men were killed, and then their wives were widowed. And the question is, could these women rebuild their lives and, you know, get married again and establish a family afterwards? It was a question that a lot of halachic authorities were dealing with after the war.
And it's a matter of, could, not should.
Could, because we just said that if your husband, a woman whose husband died al kiddush Hashem, he was martyred, so then she shouldn't get she shouldn't marry anybody else afterwards. I wouldn't say halachically not allowed, but it's brought down in the sources that she shouldn't marry somebody else. It's more, you know, I would say maybe more kabbalistically, not more than halachically. Maybe, I'm not sure if I would say it exactly like that, but that's I just said it, so there. So one of the big rabbis, Rav Yehoshua Ehrenberg, was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. So he wrote a whole response about this, and he basically wrote that this idea of a person who was martyred, his wife shouldn't marry afterwards. So that only applies, he says, to somebody who is given a choice of, you know, violating the Torah or being killed, and he chose being killed, and therefore he reaches this level of, like, he's a martyr, and therefore his wife shouldn't remarry afterwards. But a person who wasn't given a choice, and in the Holocaust, most people were not given a choice, they were just killed without being asked, right? So he says that doesn't have the halachic status of being a martyr, and therefore their wives are allowed to get married afterwards. This is somewhat controversial, because, you know, try telling somebody over the age of 70 that Holocaust or people that died in the Holocaust are not martyrs, you know, that would be considered controversial. But he said because they didn't get a choice, so they're not. That's not this level of martyrdom that we're talking about. They're people who died because of their religion, but they're not like this special level of a martyr that their wives are forbidden from being married because they were married to somebody who was so holy.
Remember, Rabbi Victor Miller mentioned something like that, and it caused a huge backlash.
Yeah, it's a controversial ruling, but in a way, it's helping save these women that were otherwise, you know, they were barred from getting married and establishing their lives after the war. So it's like, on the one hand, besmirching the, you know, the legacy of their husbands who had died, but on the other hand, freeing them and allowing them to get married and continue on with their lives. Okay, so we would just finish the discussion of women that you're not allowed to marry. Now we're going to talk about who you should marry. What do you have the time?
4:47.
Okay, so I don't know how much of this we're going to get done today. We'll go into tomorrow a little bit, and then we have a few other things that I want to discuss tomorrow. Some miscellaneous things about Jewish marriage that we'll get into tomorrow. Okay, so who should you marry? So a lot of people have all kinds of different ideas about, like, who they want to marry, what type of girl they want to marry, how tall she is, what color hair she has, exactly how her voice is supposed to sound, and how many pounds she's supposed to weigh. All these different ideas of what exactly they're looking for in a wife. So that's not what I'm going to talk about, because, you know, that's sort of a subjective thing that each person, to his own taste, whatever he's looking for in terms of that. But we're going to look more in terms of, you know, qualities, and in terms of other factors that should play a more important role. I mean, obviously, I mean, this, I don't even have to say this, but, you know, this is obvious that physical attraction is a definite must in marriage. If you're not physically attracted, the whole question doesn't even start. Should I marry her? Should I not marry her? Well, the question is, you know, do you like the way she looks or not? That's for sure. That's for sure true. And it's also for sure true, and some people tend sometimes forget about this, that another factor in essential factor for marriage is that you have to have shared goals. You have to be going in the same direction, right? If my life goal is to do this and her life goal is to do that, and these two life goals conflict with each other, and, you know, they're at odds with each other, so then the whole thing doesn't start. You can't even begin to think about marriage. Just you're not even potential candidates for marriage, right, Shlomo?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what do we say about marriage? So there's a lot of different things to say about marriage. We'll start with the most famous statement that the rabbis said about marriage. The Gemara says, "Arba'im yayim kadem yitzirus havlad," 40 days before the formation of a child, a bas kol, a heavenly voice, announces, "Bas pleini lepleini," the daughter of so and so will marry so and so. So this is something to keep in mind. The Gemara says that matchmaking is as difficult as splitting the sea. It's something that requires divine intervention. It's not something that can happen naturally. Everything, all of these things, any match that happens, any people that gets married, that actually get married, is all from Hashem. You can't force anything to happen, and you never know from which area or from which direction it's going to come. It's just certain siyata nishmaya, divine assistance, divine help. There's no magical potion, no magical key to doing it. It just, you do what you can try to do. You know, what's it called, hishtadlus, you do whatever you can try to do, and then Hashem will help seal the deal.
So there are people that doesn't happen to them, that this voice that comes down and says so and so is going to get married?
No, I understand, that doesn't happen. Everyone has their person that they're supposed to marry. Now, the Kabbalists talk about that a person could do certain sins and then lose his basharet. You can lose his, you know, soulmate, if you want to call it that, and you can do that, and then you'll have to work your way up to try to get back to it. Right? But I think that, from what I understand, that everyone, at least potentially, has their person that they're supposed to marry. They're destined to marry that way. Yes, Joe.
Are you assuming that if you married that person, then that's your bashir? Or sometimes you get it wrong?
So the people, they do say that you can sometimes get it wrong, and maybe on the first marriage you got it wrong, and the second marriage you might get it right. There is such a concept. We're not Kabbalists, so we don't know exactly. Did you get it right? Did you get it wrong? You work with what you have here in this world. We don't know all these esoteric Kabbalistic things that are beyond us. We could just talk about it, but that's, yeah.
So I heard somewhere, like, if you're dating somebody, that, like, you know, you're preventing, if you're with somebody, you're preventing from meeting your soulmate. So, like, if you're with somebody you're not supposed to be with, then you're preventing yourself from meeting that. Hashem won't just give you that, bring you that person into your life until you get rid of that person yourself.
It could be. It makes sense. In a way, it makes sense. I don't know. I don't know specifically of a source that says that exactly that, but yeah. There's an interesting thing. The way the Gemara says it, it says Bas Pliny La Pliny, the daughter of so and so will marry so and so, right? So it's a very interesting way of formulating the match. The daughter of so and so will marry so and so. The question is, well, why doesn't it say, you know, instead of saying the daughter of John Doe is going to marry Alex, just say, you know, Jane is going to marry Alex, right? Why does it say the daughter of so and so is going to marry so and so? Say the girl's name and the boy's name. Why does it say the daughter of the guy's future father-in-law is going to marry this guy? Why does it say it like that? So some of the sources want to say, based on this, that because we're talking about 40 days before this guy is formed, right? Quite 40 days before Yetzirah Savlai, before he's formed as a fetus, before he's formed as a baby, right, in his mother's womb, right? 40 days before he's formed, right? And so there's a Kabbalistic idea that a man is supposed to marry a woman who's younger than him. So if we're talking about him being formed, His mate is going to be someone who doesn't even exist yet. It's not even being formed yet, right? And therefore, it's going to be, we can't talk about who she is yet, because she doesn't exist yet. So we can only talk about vis-a-vis her father. So her father's daughter is gonna marry this guy. That's what some sources want to say. So there's this idea in Kabbalah that the wife is supposed to be younger than the husband. Now, a lot of people don't do this, right? My mother was older than my father. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, famous Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch from Germany, so he specifically sought out to marry a woman who's older than him. Apparently, he said that for what he feels that he has to do in this world, he needs a more mature woman. He can't marry someone younger than himself, right? And so there is this Kabbalistic idea of marrying someone younger than you, but then it's not the only factor. It depends on who you are and what you are, what you want to do, and what she is and what she wants to do. And it could be maybe something that you take into account, but it's not the deciding factor. Of Yaakov Hillel, a prominent Kabbalist who lives across the street from here, so he writes in his response to Shalos Tshuvos Vayashav Hayom, in the first volume, in response to number 20, he talks about this at great length, and he says what I just said, that there is this Kabbalistic idea, but it's not the only thing, it's not the only requirement, it's just something to keep in mind. Yo, what were you saying?
I was saying that my wife's older than me.
Yeah. Right? He says certainly if you get an otherwise good shidduch, a person is, you know, somebody proposes an otherwise good shidduch. Just the only problem is that she happens to be older than the guy. Right? That's not a reason to reject it. That's what he says. There's a lot of different things that, you know, people are looking for. You know, there's a joke in the yeshiva world, right? Yeshiva guys. So all the yeshiva guys are looking for a girl with a PhD. Yeah, PhD. You know what PhD stands for? Papa has dough. So the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin on page 70, on page Ayin Amar Al, the Gemara says, Kol Einei Say Isha L'Shem Mamon, anyone who marries a woman for the sake of money, Havin Lebonim She'enim Huganim, is going to have children that are not, let's say, not worthy. Children that are going to be, you know, not up to par. Because he married a woman for the sake of money. What if she marries him for the money? The Gemara doesn't say that.
Well, in the ksuba, a man is supposed to support his wife. So, if a woman marries a man for his money, it's
that is what marriage is. Could be. No, but there's money, and then there's
right,
money.
Yeah, I get. There's a difference. But
the Gemara actually even says that a person who marries a woman for money, you have to know what this means. But the Gemara says that Eliyahu Navi holds him down, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu, God, whips him. Obviously, this is some sort of allegory for something else, but like you can understand what does that mean that Eliyahu Navi holds him down and God whips him.
You're not saying if her appearance happened to
No, he's marrying. It seems to be he marries her l'shem for the sake of money. L'shem mamon.
She's rich, so he's gonna marry her.
L'shem mamon means he's doing it for the money.
Sure, but what if her dad really wants her to get married, and he comes to you and he's like, "Yo, I want you to marry my daughter, and I'm rich."
Okay.
What if the guy doesn't really want to marry her, but the dad's so persistent, he likes the guy, he's a great talk to her or something like that. He's like, I got a lot of money. Marry my daughter, I'll hook you up, it'll look good.
Well, that sounds bad.
Hey, what are you saying, Jeff?
I mean, whether the father wants it or not, if you're still doing it if you're convinced because he has money, then it's still doing it because he has money.
So now I throw in the bombshell. The Ramar of Moshe Israelis, right, the leading halachic authority of the Ashkenazim, he writes that this Gemara is only talking about if you marry a woman that you're not supposed to marry. A woman that you know, all these women that we've been speaking about for the last 2 days, that you're not supposed to marry. So if you marry one of those women because of the money, so then it's a problem. That's what he says. But he says that to marry a woman that you're halachically allowed to marry, so maybe he doesn't say that it's you know, commended. But when the Gemara says that your children won't be on par and Eliyahu Navi holds you down and God whips you, that doesn't apply to such a person. And in fact, the Aruch HaShulchan, who is also one of the leading, you know, Ashkenazi rulers from about 100 years ago, the Aruch HaShulchan says that if he's a Torah scholar, so then on the contrary, there's good reason for him to marry specifically for money, because of the fact that he'll be able to be supported with the money and he'll be able to grow and continue studying in his Torah study without being, you know, without being busy with any other things. So that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. The truth is that it's not so simple, because even if you marry somebody that has a lot of money, so what tends to happen is that, first of all, women, girls that grow up in families that have a lot of money, so they have higher expectations and they spend more money as well. And so you have a lot more, but you're also using up a lot more, and then you end up losing it, and you end up having to go to work and not being able to focus on your learning as well. Right? That's one thing. The other thing is that if you have a father-in-law who's giving you money, so what happens is that he believes that because he's giving you money and you're nothing without him, so he can call the shots and he tells you exactly what to do, whether you like it or not. You have to listen to whatever he says. So you're bound. You're not bound to looking for a parnasa, but you are bound to whatever whims this father-in-law happens to have. You have to listen to whatever he says, because there's no way out of it. And what does Rabbi Victor Miller say about that? Rabbi Victor Miller says, I remember listening to one of his recordings. He said his advice to parents-in-law is to open your wallet and
shut your mouth.
There you go.
Yeah, I never remember.
Very good. So that's the women with the PhD. So what are you, what are the different things you're supposed to look at when you're looking at a prospective mate? The Gemara says that a person who wants to marry a woman, tzarech sheyivdek be'acheha, you should look at her brothers. And the Gemara learns this from actually last week's parsha when it says that it says by Aaron the Kohen, Moshe Rabbeinu's brother. So he went and says that he married. Aaron went and he took Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, the sister of Nachshon, as a wife. Right? So Aaron Akayan, he married somebody named Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav. And this lady, Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, was the brother of Nachshon.
Sister of Nachshon.
The sister of Nachshon. Just to see if you're paying attention. Right? So the Gemara says, why does it have to say that she was the sister of Nachshon? Just say that her name was Elisheva Bas Aminadav, Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav. Who cares that she was the sister of Nachshon? So the Gemara says, from here we learn that when you marry a woman, you have to look at her brothers. Her brother, Nachshon ben Aminadav, was a very prominent Jew. The Midrashim, the Gemara tells us that he was the first person to jump into the Red Sea before the sea split. He believed in Hashem so strongly that he knew that Hashem was going to save them, so he just went straight into the sea, and then Hashem made this miracle that split the sea.
The Red Sea is in Eilat, right?
Possibly.
I think I was just there.
But that only applies.
The Red Sea. Was it red?
No, that's when the sea split.
I don't know if that's where the sea. I don't know if that's exactly the site where it happened, but it's that sea. Yeah.
Doesn't that only apply if it's like an older? What if you have a younger brother? See, like in all those cases, it was an older brother. So of course, but if it's like a younger brother,
who said it was an older brother?
Well, because the way that somebody explained it to me was that you look at the brothers because the brothers help raise the sister and teach her like. They teach her like principles and all that stuff. So you look at the brothers because she's gonna have those principles. But what if the brothers are much younger than the sister, and she's the one that, you know what I mean?
Okay, so let's take it. So the Gemara says you're supposed to look at the brother, and brings this proof from Aaron marrying Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, who's the sister of Nachshon, and Nachshon is this prominent Jew who ends up being the prince of the tribe of Yehuda, etc. So why are you supposed to look at the brothers of this prospective bride? Why do you look at the brothers? So Gemara says, because Raiv Banim Daimim La'ache Ha'im. Most children are similar to the brothers of the mother. So if you want to know how your children are going to look, they're going to look similar to your wife's brothers. Oh man, that's horrible.
Yeah,
I was just thinking about my wife's brothers. So what does that mean? Diamond? What does diamond mean? Does it mean that they share the same DNA? I think they have an eighth of their DNA is going to end up the same, something like that. Right? Does that mean it's talking about because of the DNA they're going to physically look, or is it like what you're saying that the older brothers help raise the younger siblings, and therefore the older siblings are going to have an influence on the younger siblings, and they're going to resemble each other, right? And so if that's true, so Rav Yaakov, I heard this in the name of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, says that nowadays it's not just a person's nuclear family that has an impact or an influence on their life, especially on the girls. So in olden times, you know, women, girls didn't go to school, so they stayed at home. So who was the strongest influence on them? The mother, their father, and their siblings, right? He says nowadays girls go to school, they go outside, they're part of the world at large, and therefore they have other influences. So the influence of their brother is not going to be as strong as it once was. So it's not all telling as it used to be. That's what Yaakov Kamenetsky says. So that understands the idea is that the influence. The other idea is that it's a question exactly how relevant and how to apply this nowadays. But that's one thing, one piece of advice the Gemara says. Another piece of the Gemara says, right? He said so you should check the brothers. Another piece of advice the Medrash says is that if another thing you should check is you check a girl's eyes. The Gemara says that if she has beautiful eyes, then you don't need to check the rest of her body. She must be entirely beautiful. I don't know what that means, but that's what the Medrash says. That was, yeah.
Well, I thought you're not supposed to make eye contact.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
It's only bears.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry, they're more scared of you than you are of them.
Same tactics, I think. Yeah. You come across a brown bear, or a black bear, or a girl with black hair, you fight back. Brown girl with brown hair, you're
wrong.
Or you just run.
You're wrong.
What about blonde hair?
So what about the polar bear?
Stand very still.
There's another thing we can learn out from the Torah. In the book of Genesis, in chapter 24, so Avraham Avinu sends his trusty servant Eliezer on a mission to go find a shidduch, to go find a match for his son Yitzchak. And so Eliezer goes to Avraham Avinu's homeland, and he's there at the well. And what's the sign that he says? He says, "The girl that comes and says that I'm going to give you water and give water for your camels." He has traveling with this entourage of 10 camels. So he says, that's the girl that Hashem has chosen for my master's son. Right? So what do you see from that? You see from that that kindness, right, character traits, is a very important thing when deciding on who to marry. Right? The one thing, how do I know that this is the girl that I should bring for Yitzchak? Because she's going to offer to feed me, or to bring me something to drink, to draw water from the well, and to feed my animals. That's how I know she's the one, because she's kind. Right? So that if we extrapolate that to ourselves, so that tells us that what should we be looking for in a spouse? You're looking for a girl who exhibits this character trait of kindness and other good, you know, character traits of the personality. I think we are going to stop over here, and we'll continue tomorrow with who you should marry, and we'll do some other miscellaneous things that are related to the concept of Jewish marriage. If anyone has any specific things they want me to try to speak about tomorrow, you can tell me now, and I'll try to research it and come up with something coherent to say.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for staying.